afternoon, and welcome to the Narrow Path radio broadcast. My name is Steve Gregg, and we're live from 2 to 3 in the afternoon Pacific time. If you would like to participate in the show today during the live broadcast, you can call in with questions that may be rattling around in your mind, things related to the Bible or Christianity or your own religious views and questions. If you want to ask such a question, we can talk about that here. Or if you have heard this host give answers to questions before and you didn't agree with the viewpoint that was expressed, you're more than welcome to call and disagree, to call and balance comment. The point of the program is not to promote the views of this host, although, of course, the views of this host will be mentioned. But you certainly are welcome to mention views contrary to the views of the host and to give a defense for them, too, because, really, the truth is what we're interested in. And we're not interested in promoting some man's teaching, including my own. We're interested in what the Bible has to say, and if my own understanding of the Bible is deficient, then you do me a favor and our listeners if you bring it around to a correct way of looking at it. So the number to call is 1-800-438-5090. That's 1-800-438-5090. I keep hearing from more and more of our Seattle listeners. Now, we've been on in Seattle for just under 2 months now. And so I've been hearing from Seattle listeners who like the program, and a few have even sent in some support for the program, which I appreciate. I just wanted to say that it's coming up to the end of the month again. We'll begin our third month on the first of the month of May. And that's also when I have to pay for another month. And it costs thousands of dollars to be on the programs, or that is to be on the stations that we're on. And I'd just like to suggest maybe some of our new Seattle listeners, if you've become appreciative of the program, that you might consider, whether keeping us on the air on KCIS is something that's worthwhile to you. If it's not, then fine. I mean, honestly, we're glad to have you listen, even if you can't support us or if you don't feel comfortable supporting us. It's just that the money we pay to be on in Seattle up to this point has come almost entirely from listeners in other areas who aren't listening in Seattle because, frankly, some of them actually wanted you people in Seattle to be able to hear the program. Some have designated gifts, thousands of dollars, to help us out in these first couple months. And, of course, the decision of whether we'll stay on the air in Seattle will be whether the area shows some interest in keeping us on sufficiently to be able to pay the bills. Anyway, I just want to let you know that because some people don't know that the stations or the programs you're listening to on Christian radio are paying for the time, and they're paying a lot for the time. It costs thousands of dollars each month to be on the radio. And some people think actually that we're paid to be on the radio. So I have to clarify that once in a while because sometimes people say, oh, I didn't know you paid to be on. I thought you got paid. No, I don't get paid anything for doing this show, and we do pay a lot of money out to the stations that carry the program. So I want you to be aware of that, and especially our new listeners. Our lines are full, so I need to go to the phones right now. If you do want to help us out, you can go to our website, and you can see our address or a PayPal link there. It's at thenarrowpath.com. If you don't want to help us out yet, that's fine, too, because we're not coveting your money at all. We don't get any of it anyway. All the money that comes in goes back to the radio stations and the telephone company that we buy the 800 time from. So it really doesn't have an effect on me, whether you give. I don't receive anything from it. But the listeners in your area are the ones affected if we stay on or don't stay on the air. Let's talk to Sandy. Oh, by the way, the website is thenarrowpath.com, thenarrowpath.com. Sandy from San Jose, California, welcome to The Narrow Path.
Hey, Steve, it's always a pleasure.
Good to hear from you.
Yeah, thanks. I break out of my day here and do my late lunch. So first of all, one thing about the truth, just mentioning, it's interesting because in John, when Jesus is talking to Pilate, right, he said, for this reason I was born, and for this reason I came into the world to testify to the truth. So truth was on trial, right, with Pilate, and that was one of the main reasons Jesus came into the world, I believe. And so it's good that you're promoting truth because I think we're sorely missing it out there.
I think that's what God is honored by if we promote truth rather than just one opinion about the truth. We need to be open to the possibility that we could be wrong about some things, and if we are, we need to be as eager to change our mind as we are to defend our position.
Amen, and that's not always an easy thing to do when we have a certain way of viewing things. So had a couple questions. One is just a real brief question in terms of terminology, and then I'm going to jump to a question in, I think, Ezekiel. Given that dispensationalism is new, and I don't know who actually coined the term, if that was Darby or not, someone who's not a dispensationalist, which I'm not, what do I call myself? I know that we don't have to call ourselves anything, right? We're just Christian, right? But I like putting labels on things. I think there's so many labels in Christianism, and maybe, again, it's bad, but you know, people say, "Oh, you're a you know, partial preterist." You know, I mean, what is a person who's not a dispensationalist? A non-dispensationalist?
Well, that would be the broadest label to give. It would be non-dispensational. Sometimes that's what I will say about myself. If people want to know more specifically what I believe, there's other labels for different parts of my belief system. There's quite a lot of ways that a person can be non-dispensationalist. One of the common labels that is put in contrast to dispensationalism is covenant theology.
Right, right.
Another would be Reformed theology. But Reformed theology particularly includes Calvinism, and not all non-dispensationalists are Calvinistic. So that term doesn't fit everybody.
What does covenant mean then? Covenant.
Well, covenant theology is the view that God has entered into one covenant of grace when he created mankind. And that covenant of grace is the only covenant that God has ever made, although it has undergone some modifications and so forth, for example, with the coming of Christ into a newness of the covenant. But this is in contrast to dispensationalism's idea that God has made seven different covenants that have changed the terms of man's relationship with God seven times in history. So covenant theology holds that there is only one covenant that God has always honored between himself and his created beings, which is the covenant of grace. As far as the details of it, I don't know all that is involved in the term. But, I mean, there is amillennialism.
Right, right.
And there is postmillennialism. And there is even historic premillennialism. Yeah, that's not dispensational. So there's a lot of alternatives to dispensational. Now, you mentioned preterist.
Right.
Preterist isn't really a theological camp. Amillennialism, postmillennialism, premillennialism, those are theological categories. Preterism is simply a question of how you interpret a few different prophecies. Do you interpret the Olivet Discourse as being fulfilled in the past or fulfilled in the future? Do you interpret the Book of Revelation as being fulfilled in the past or in the future? That question will determine whether you're a futurist or a preterist. But that has to do not so much with your whole system of theology, because you could be a preterist, I suppose, and still hold to some forms of, premillennialism, I think. Preterism just would be a question of how do you understand the Olivet Discourse, how do you understand the Book of Revelation, and, frankly, a lot of Old Testament prophecies, too, but most people aren't thinking about those when they use the word preterist.
Got it. I just love these terms. Up until a couple of years ago, I didn't know these terms existed. I thought everything was, you know, Tim LaHaye and all that left behind was it. So I've left all that behind, basically. But here's my real question. So I do listen to Gary DeMar and American Vision. I like those guys for the most part.
Uh-huh.
And Gary was saying that Ezekiel 38:39 and Zechariah 12 were fulfilled in the book of Esther.
I know that's his view.
And then I don't know. And then I went and looked at other places, and some other places said it was the Maccabees or somewhere in that generation that it was fulfilled. And I'm just curious what your opinion is.
Yeah, well, I believe that Zechariah 12 is related to the period of the Maccabees.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, not to the time of Esther. Now, as far as Ezekiel 38 and 39, the idea that that's from the time of Esther is an idea I had never heard before I heard it from Gary DeMar a few years ago. But it has merit. Ezekiel 38 and 39 have been perplexing chapters for a very long time. They talk about Gog, the chief prince of Magog. Well, we don't know of any king ever known by that name. And talks about him invading the land of unwalled villages. And it's told in very apocalyptic terms how that fire and brimstone come out of heaven and wipe out 5/6 of the armies of Gog. And then they're burning the weapons for 7 years and burying the dead for 7 months and so forth. These are very apocalyptic images and probably not literal. because apocalyptic writing usually is not intended to be taken literally.
When you say apocalyptic, apocalypse means revealed, right?
Right, but the reason it's called apocalyptic literature is because the book of Revelation in the Greek is called the Apocalypse, or the Apocalypsis in the Greek. And the book of Revelation is actually the book that gives that word apocalyptic as a label to a lot of different earlier types of writing. In other words, back in the days of Ezekiel and Zechariah, they didn't refer to their writings as apocalyptic, but they were a certain style of writing that was also very prominent in the non-canonical Jewish books in the intertestamental period, and then later in some New Testament documents like the book of Revelation. They're all of the same style. They didn't really have a name for that genre until somebody just observing that, you know, the book of Revelation was of the same genre, and it's called the Apocalypse. They simply referred to all of those books that are written that way as apocalyptic style. In other words, that means in the style of the book of Revelation.
Okay, got it. So did you see then this, just close my file here, I just had it here, the ones we were just talking about with Derek Marbley's, do you see that as true, or you're not quite sure yourself then?
Well, to my mind, it has merit. I don't have certainty myself as to what Ezekiel 38 and 39 are talking about. I do believe that they are symbolic in their style of writing, but they're certainly talking about some kind of a massive pagan attack on Israel after the return of the exiles from Babylon.
Right.
That's what is described, and that's the time frame. So, because you have the return of the exiles from Babylon in the previous chapter 37,
mm-hmm.
and then you have Gog and these armies like the sand of the seashore coming up against the land of unwalled villages, which would be Israel when their villages have not yet rebuilt their walls after returning from the exile. And there are a couple of known things in history that could fit this description. One is the assault on the Jews in Persia in the book of Esther, and the other would be Antiochus Epiphanes and his wars against the Jews right in the land of Israel. I've tended to favor the idea that it's Antiochus Epiphanes that is referred to as Gog there, but it may not be. No one knows for sure. Of course, the popular view today is that it's
right.
some future Israel. War and Russia coming down against Israel in the modern days. But I don't think the evidence for that is strong in Scripture. It's a very popular view these days, but it's I don't think it's the best view in terms of the context of the passage. But which war it is, I'm not sure. It could easily be the one in Esther.
Okay, so what Gary's saying is it could be true. There's no way to rule it out, but we're not absolutely certain.
Exactly. I think Gary makes a good point. I don't know that he's sealed up the case.
Got it. Okay. Always a pleasure, Steve. I got thousands of more questions, but I'll let you get your next caller, and I'll call another day. So I always appreciate it.
Okay, Sandy. Thanks for your call.
Take care. Bye-bye.
You too. Bye now. All right. Our next caller is Don from Salem, Oregon. Don, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
I wanted to pick up on our discussion yesterday.
Yes, we ran out of time.
About
sorry.
People, why don't they accept Christ when they're faced with evidence that that he's there, that everything logically works his way.
I would say a lot of people would say that the starting point of your statement, namely that there's lots of evidence that he's there and that everything works his way, they would say they don't accept that part. You know, you and I may say, and I would say, that the evidence is incredibly strong, that Jesus is there, that God is there, and that he's ruling history. And based on that, it would seem nonsensical for anyone not to believe in him. But many people don't start with that premise. They look at the world and they say, I don't see any evidence of God. I don't see any evidence that God's work is being done here in the world. And they're seeing different things than we are. For one thing, they're not looking at the big picture of world history. And for another thing, they're looking at the same evidence that you and I see. And they're looking at it through a more skeptical and a more, what we'd have to say, naturalistic lens. They're not willing to see the supernatural in things that you and I would readily see the supernatural in, like the design of a cell, you know, or something like that.
I introduced talking about a case for faith by Lee Strobel.
Yes.
And when he gets into this chapter about why they don't, some of the reasons he gives is one person has guessed that it's going to cost too much.
That certainly is a reason that many people don't turn to Christ. Certainly.
There's one case they gave was a university professor who seemed to lean that direction. However, he had a certain amount of prestige and recognition within his society, the university society, and therefore he would have to give up that social group, or they would give him up.
Precisely.
The price is just too high.
Yeah, I would agree with that assessment. I'm sure that's why many people don't turn to Christ. That is, the ones who do see the evidence and do think it's strong. You see, like I was saying, many people do not see the evidence, or they don't consider the evidence strong, and that's why they don't give it any more thought. But there are some who do see that the evidence is there, and they do consider that the, you know, Christianity is probably true, but they also take a look at the ledger and say, well, what's this going to cost me? Well, it may cost me the respect of my peers in my field. It may cost me my marriage. It might cost me the respect of my neighbors or whatever. It might even, in some parts of the world, it might even lead to my persecution, my being persecuted. And so there is a cost involved in following Christ, and lots of people, you know, every human being needs to make a decision. We're all in the position to decide, what will we love most? Will we love God most and be loyal to Him at all costs? Or will we love something else, usually something related to our own happiness is what's, you know, on the list there. And so, you know, keeping my friends happy with me, keeping my job, keeping my, you know, my money and not having to make any sacrifices. I mean, Christ makes demands. He makes demands on our possessions. He makes demands on our relationships. He makes demands on our time and everything. So a lot of people understand that and say, well, you know, those are demands I don't really want to meet. And in other words, I want to be loyal to something other than God. I want to love something more than I love God. And the great command, Jesus said, is that you shall love God with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength. That's the great commandment. It's the first one. And the other is to love your neighbors, you love yourself. So that's really the choice put before every human being. Will you do what God said? That is, put Him first. Love Him above all things. And see what that ends up bringing you. You know, sure, it'll cost you. But I don't believe that God would put a price tag on a thing that's above its value. God is gracious and generous. If anything, I would think the price tag is below its value. Jesus said, what shall it profit a man if he gains the whole world and loses his soul? Well, the price tag of losing your soul is, or of gaining the world, is that you lose your soul. That's a big price tag. And I don't suppose most of us have the capacity to really assess how big that price tag is until we die and we find ourselves among those who've lost their souls. But it is a huge price tag. And Jesus indicates that it is, for example, in another place, Jesus said, if your eye causes you to sin, and he means by this if it prevents you from becoming a follower of his, he says, pluck it out and cast it from you because it's more profitable for you to enter into life with one eye than having two eyes be cast into Gehenna, you know, the fire of Gehenna. Now, what he's saying here is it's going to cost you sometimes. If your eye or your hand or your foot, he says, would keep you from coming into the kingdom, well, it's going to cost you that. Take it out. Now, he's not being literal because no one really is kept out of the kingdom by their eye or their hand or their foot. What he's saying is if there is something in your life, it might be a possession or a position or a relationship or, you know, a reputation or something else like that, which you value as much as you would value your hand or your eye or your foot. Well, you have to decide, do I want to keep the thing or do I want God? Jesus said it's profitable for you to be without your eye and to enter into the kingdom rather than to keep it and miss out on that. So what we see that God is looking out for our profit in this matter when he says, you know, it's going to cost you, but he says it's worth it to you. You'll profit by it. It's much better for you. What he's offering is far better than anything it can cost us, apparently, from what he's saying. And so people don't understand that. And, you know, Someone said the other day, I think it was a pastor of the church I was listening to preaching at or somewhere else, said the main characteristic of maturity is the willingness to delay gratification. And I think we have a bunch of immature people who don't want to delay gratification. They want gratification now. They think a bird in the hand is worth two in the bush. And so they don't want Jesus now because that'll cost them something they want to have now. Of course, later, when they find they've lost something of infinite value, then they'll have their time to, you know, think about whether they made a good choice or not. But I think smart people think about that now and say, well, how am I going to feel about this decision 100 years from now? But if I'm choosing between God and mammon, or between God and a relationship, or God and anything, if I make the wrong choice, how am I going to feel about that choice 200, 300, 500, 1,000 years from now, 1,000,000 years from now? How am I going to look at that choice? Smart people look ahead and decide accordingly. But I think your question, why do so many people not believe? I don't think they're that smart.
He takes a person which I had never heard of before. Well, no, I had heard of him before, but I couldn't remember his name. Charles Templeton.
Yeah.
And he laid out the case for it. Templeton was a leading evangelical preacher.
He was a friend of Billy Graham's in their early days.
Very close.
Yeah.
As a matter of fact, even in his closing days, they were still close friends.
Yeah, but Templeton went in the way of liberal theology and skepticism.
That's right.
Yeah.
And he died an atheist. He would just not accept. And near the end of the book, he was taking Templeton's case, and he didn't know exactly what it took, because he started off, he accepted Christ when he was, I think, 16 or something like that,
mm-hmm.
and really dove in the deep end and was really an outstanding evangelist. He's a great salesman for the gospel. And then he started questioning some things. Why is there suffering? And he said, if there is a good God would not allow this kind of suffering, like plagues and
That is one of the big arguments people use against God.
Yeah, and he never resolved the problem. Strobel actually interviewed him, and he talked freely about it. He seemed to be emotionally struck by Jesus Christ as mm-hmm. a man, but he just did not accept this, accept him as Lord. He rejected that and never came back. I think there's another thing, though.
What's that?
And that, I think, is they're playing a game. It's fun to get in and intellectualize the gospel. Why God allows this, why it doesn't do that. And I think they're being, for want of a better word, they're being cute.
Well, sure. Yeah, when people think that Christianity is not true or that religion is not true, they often have a rather condescending attitude toward religious ideas and are willing to be somewhat to smirk at it and to make fun of it to treat it like it's a cute subject rather than a matter of life and death.
When I was a kid, I liked to go gray digger hunting, and I had a dog, Bingo. We'd jump in the pickup and go out in the country, and I parked the car, and he jumped out. And then he started barking, and I wanted to see what he was barking at. There was a rattlesnake there. It was coiled, rattling, and I yelled at the dog, "Get out of the way! Get out of the way!" And I couldn't get an angle at the snake to shoot it. And he wouldn't come. And I got so frustrated with that dog. He wanted to stay there and, I don't know, play with the snake or what. But it was dangerous. And I got so mad, I almost wanted to shoot the dog. He wouldn't obey. And I did get snake, and I didn't shoot the doll.
Yeah.
But I think that there are people who are playing with snakes, and they're deadly, and they like to bark a lot at them, but what they don't know is that snake can catch them.
Well, just resist the temptation to shoot those people, Don.
Yeah. Well, I think God just... I'm not sure if God has an appointed day in a Calvinistic sense. That's it. There's a date out there that we have to meet. I don't know.
Yeah.
But there is a day out there that we are going to die. And we don't know when it is. We all have experiences with people who have gone home and died. In our church, we had a man.
People die quite young. Listen, Don, we're going on and on here. Now I got my lines totally full.
Right. Okay. Anyhow, I hope our friend, the atheist, I don't know what his name is, I hope he'll pick up this A Case for Faith if he's really looking for some answers. For his questions. I think the questions are raised, and I think the answers are given.
All right, Don. That's a good recommendation.
And I'll get off. Thanks.
Thanks for your call.
Bye.
God bless you. Bye-bye now. All right, we're going to talk next to Isabel, who's been waiting for a long time in Beaverton, Oregon. Thank you for waiting, Isabel. Welcome to The Narrow Path.
Thank you. Thank you for having me on your show. Steve, I have been listening to your program from on and off, and I had some issues about your philosophy about tithes and offerings.
Yes.
How do you back up Malachi 3 then? I think it's Malachi 3.
Yeah, Malachi 3, the prophet says.
How do you back up that? Why is anything wrong with tithing and offerings?
Well, Malachi is criticizing the Jewish people who've come back from Babylon, because that's the time he's living in and the people he's talking to, and he's saying that they have been neglecting to pay their tithes. Now, the law of Moses said that they have to pay their tithes to support the Levites. The Levites were the full-time ministers who were attending to the temple, and the priests were supported by the tithes, too. And so the support of the temple and the sacrifices and the full-time workers there was to be done through the tithes that the other 11 tribes would bring to support that one tribe of Levi. And so because they were neglecting it, the prophet rebuked them and said they're robbing God. They're not holding up their responsibility, and they're neglecting the sacrifices and the priests and so forth of the house of God and the support of them. I don't have any problem with that. I mean, I think those people were having that issue. I think they were... I can accept what Malachi said at face value. What I don't see is how that relates to me. The Bible doesn't ever command people in the New Testament to tithe. We don't have a temple. We don't have Levites. We don't have priests. There's no parallel there. I mean, the system that was supported by the tithes of the Israelites is a system that doesn't exist anymore. And so, in my opinion... The passage can be taken just like any other passage in the Old Testament that, Malachi also criticizes them because they're bringing blind and lame animals for animal sacrifices, and he tells them they should bring the best lambs and the best animals for their sacrifices. Well, I agree with that too, but that doesn't make me think that I need to bring a lamb somewhere and offer a sacrifice.
Mm-hmm. In a more personal context, do you tithe?
Do I tithe? Well, tithing means 10%. No, I don't tithe. I pay multiple tithes. That is my tithing. My giving far exceeds 10%. I would never limit my giving to a tithe. Tithing is, to my mind, chintzy. If you're living in America and you're anything other than, in poverty, then I think that giving 10% is cheating, because I believe that it's not enough. We are the richest people in the world, and we live the fanciest, most comfortable lifestyles in the world. And if we can't give more than God requires of peasants in Palestine to be giving, then, I don't know, our love for God is very deficient, it seems to me. But this has nothing to do with obligation to give a certain amount. This has to do with stewardship.
It's hard to,
It has to do with your heart. That's right. I mean, if you are a steward of God's things, and that means the house you live in, the car you drive, the money that comes to you in your paycheck or any other way your money comes to you, even if you earned it, of course, people say, well, I earned it. This is mine. Wait a minute. You earned it with what? With your time? No, God's time. You're not your own. You've been bought with a price. You're a slave. God owns you. He owns your time. Every dollar you make is his dollar. And everything you have is his. And the question then is, what are you doing with his stuff? Now, there's certainly nothing wrong with using God's things to support the needs of his servants, including you and your own family. Nothing wrong with that. If you are God's servant, he intends for your needs to be met. But if he's given you more than what you need, the reason is because you're a steward of his things. He expects you to support the things that he cares about, including the poor, including the spread of the gospel, and so forth.
Okay.
I mean, so in other words, if a person can pay their bills and they can eat and wear clothes and drive their car and pay their rent and have money left over, and most Americans at least used to be in that condition before this recession. I don't know how it is now, but, I have found that I can keep my lifestyle below the national average, way below, and give a lot more money that way. And that's what I prefer to do, because someday we're going to stand before God and he's going to say, okay, I gave you X number of dollars in your lifetime. That was mine, of course. And he says, and so I just want to see how you used my money. And if he says, oh, I noticed you got a new car every 2 years. And you got a new stereo system every time there was an upgrade in the technology. And you got a new this and a new that all the time. And you lived in a house much larger than you or your family needed. Then I don't want to be in the person's shoes who has to answer to God that way. You know, because he's the master. We're the servants. And he owns it all. So I'm glad. I'm very happy to take more than a tithe. Well, far more than a tithe. And to give it away to the poorer people than myself. That's what I've been doing
so
for the past 40 years.
We shouldn't see the tithe as a biblical command, but as a moral command. For instance, if I belong to the club, I have to pay a fee to be a member of that club. So it's a financial responsibility by choice. So if I'm going to be in a home church as a moral obligation, and I know they have a lot of expenses depend on the church. And I agree with your opinion of big buildings and those kind of things, but that is more personal decision thing. I don't really want to put my finger there. But
what I'm saying is this. I don't see the need to use the word tithe, because the word tithe specifically is an old word that means tenth, okay? And there's nothing in the New Testament that says that Christians should give one-tenth. What the New Testament says, Jesus said in Luke chapter 14, verse 33, said, unless you forsake all that you have, you cannot be my disciple. And in the New Testament, in the book of Acts, in chapters 2 and 4, it says the early disciples, the early Christians, did not consider that any of the things they possessed were their own. But they had all things common, and they shared with everyone who had need. Now, that doesn't mean that there's some kind of a mandate to live in community, but it means that the early Christians understood that all their things belong to God.
Yes.
And that they needed to be concerned about the things God's concerned about with his and invest his money in the kind of investments he would want his money invested in. And we need to look around at our standard of living and say, if Jesus were living in this house, how many of these things would he have bought? You know, because the things he would have bought is the stuff I should buy. That's really the way I should look at it. It's his money, and I'm his slave, and I'm managing his stuff. And if there's stuff that he wouldn't buy, I shouldn't buy, seems to me. So that's how we look at it. And then if we'd ask, well, what would Jesus do with all this extra money? Then once our standard of living is trailed down to, you know, something reasonable, and there's all this money left over, what would Jesus do with that? Now, you say, well, the local church needs it. Well, then he might give it to the local church. He might give some of it to the local church and some of it to missionaries and some of it to other places. But the point is, there's nothing in the Bible that says you take 10th and give it to the local church.
Mm-hmm. Okay. My last question is very quickly here is, tell me briefly about the first, the second, and the third heaven, and what is in the second heaven?
Well, there's nothing stated about that in Scripture. The third heaven is the only heaven mentioned that is numbered like that, first, second, third. And that's in 2 Corinthians 12, where Paul said he knew a man who had been caught up into the third heaven, whether in the body or out of the body, he did not know. I think the indication is he was caught up into the presence of God. He said he was caught up even into paradise, and he heard things that were unlawful for him to repeat. So I think he's referring to having been caught up like John was in the book of Revelation into heaven where the throne of God was, and where he, you know, had revelations from God, some of which he couldn't even repeat. Now, the first and second heavens, Paul does not identify, but the normal way that Christians explain that, and I'll just follow the normal way because I don't know any other way to do it, is that in the Bible there are three different heavens that are mentioned. They're not called the first, second, and third, but we could think of them that way. The first heavens is the sky. That is the local sky, the atmosphere, where the birds the birds fly in the heavens.
The firmament.
The firmament, right, exactly. And then the second heavens would be the universe out there where all the stars and stuff are. And then the third heaven would be the spiritual realm where God himself lives, where his throne is.
So that second heaven is where Satan habitates in
heaven? No, not necessarily. No. Second, no, I don't think he's out in outer space. No, Satan is right around here. He walks on the earth, the Bible says, if you read the book of Job.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, Dave, I think you answered all my questions. Thank you so much.
Okay, Isabel, thanks for your call.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye now. All right, our next question is, our next caller is Nick from Kelso, Washington, and we have line open for you at 1-800-438-5090. You're welcome to call with any question you have about the Bible or Christianity. We can talk about it. Call with a disagreement if you have one. 1-800-438-5090. My name's Steve Gregg, and you're listening to The Narrow Path. Nick from Kelso, welcome.
Hi, Steve. This is Nick.
Hey, good to hear from you.
My question is from 1 Corinthians chapter 15, verse 29.
Okay.
I'm sure you've been asked that before.
About the baptism for the dead?
Yes.
Yes.
And I guess part of my question is in verse 12, does that set the context for verse 29?
You know, I think it is. And I'm not sure where you're going with this, but you might be going the same way I go on it. Verse 29 says, otherwise, what will they do who are baptized for the dead if the dead do not rise at all? Why then are they baptized for the dead? Now, if you ask most Christian teachers, you know, what this is talking about, it seems like most of them usually say that Paul was aware of some sect somewhere, maybe one of the mystery religions, that were baptizing people by proxy for dead people. That is, people had died without being baptized, so someone was being baptized, a live person was being baptized on their behalf. But I don't think that's necessarily what Paul's talking about here. And you bring up verse 12, which is a good cross-reference, because Paul says, now, if Christ has preached that he has been raised from the dead, how do some say that there is no resurrection of the dead? And he goes on to say in verse 13, but if there is no resurrection of the dead, then Christ is not risen. In other words, if there's no resurrection of the dead, then Christ is dead. And then verse 29 says, and why would people be baptized for the dead? That is, why would people be baptized in the name of Jesus? Why would they be baptized for Christ? If the dead don't rise, that means Christ is dead. Then why would people be baptized with reference to the dead, meaning to Christ? So that's what I think he's talking about. What do you think?
I think exactly that same thing. I think that I agree. If the dead rise not, then Christ is dead.
That's right.
And therefore they are baptized for the dead. Now then, in the next verse or the next couple verses, where he says, I protest by your rejoicing, does that have something to do with the fact that here they are, fellowshipping with and baptizing people that do not even believe in the resurrection? You know, is that why you protest?
I'm not sure I understand that part of the question. Say that again.
Well, I just... In the next, I think, one or two verses, he says something like, I protest by your rejoicing.
Yeah, the New King James says, I affirm by the boasting in you, which I have in Christ Jesus.
Oh, okay.
It reads a little differently.
Okay. Well, all right. Well, yeah, that basically, that I just wanted to know your opinion on that. I think that, you know, we think just alike on that.
Yeah, I'll tell you, I had only heard the other view all my life, and the view I just shared with you, which is apparently your view also, I was the first person I knew to ever hold, to come to that opinion. It's just as I was thinking about the whole passage, the whole chapter, it seemed to me like that was the correct understanding, that Paul was saying, if there's no resurrection, then Christ is dead. And why would people be baptized with reference to Christ if he's dead, if there's no resurrection? But I had never heard anyone say that before, so it's interesting that you would see it that way too.
Well, that is interesting, and I had heard that same thing, and I just couldn't make sense of it, and I thought that by bringing in this other sect that supposedly baptized by proxy, I thought that it was just taking it totally out of context.
Yeah.
I just couldn't make it make sense to me.
Well, you know, the Mormons have always used that verse to try to justify their practice of baptizing people for their dead relatives. And in answer to the Mormons, Christians often say, well, you know, Paul knew of people who did this, but he wasn't sponsoring it. He wasn't supporting it. But Paul is here making an argument for a Christian doctrine, the doctrine of the resurrection of the dead. And why would he appeal to a practice of some cult group that he didn't approve of as a support for a Christian doctrine? I don't think that would be as likely as what we suggested. By the way, Nick, there's an awful lot of noise in the background there. It's kind of distracting. Where are you anyway?
I'm driving down the freeway, so
I see.
Apologize for that. But Steve, thank you very much, and God bless you.
Thank you, Nick. Good to hear from you.
All right.
Okay, bye now. Okay, we're going to talk to a caller from Everett, Washington. Michael in Everett, Washington, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Yes, yeah, Steve. I have a question regarding Acts 15, and in particular, it is verse 19 through verse 21, about the four things that the conversions,
yes,
Gentiles were to keep according to the Jerusalem Council.
Right.
Could you elaborate on that for me, please?
Sure, yeah. Now, for those who don't know, this council was convened because Paul and Barnabas had been converting Gentiles and not requiring them to be circumcised. And prior to that, only Jewish people had become Christians, and of course they were circumcised. And in their frame of reference, Jesus was the Jewish Messiah. So if you become a Christian, a follower of Jesus, you become a Jew who follows the Messiah. And in Old Testament times, if a Gentile wanted to become a Jew, he had to get circumcised. And here Paul was leading people to Christ who were Gentiles, and he was not required them to be circumcised. So there was confusion as to whether Gentiles who became Christians ought to be circumcised or not and become Jewish. So they convened to talk about that. And after Peter and Paul and others had testified, James proposes a solution. And basically his solution is that, no, the Gentiles do not have to become Jewish. They don't have to become circumcised or keep the law. But he says, let's write to them and ask them at least to observe these four things. And the four things he wants them to observe are that they abstain from meat sacrificed to idols, from sexual immorality, from eating things that were strangled, and also from eating blood. Three of these are dietary restrictions. Don't eat meat sacrificed to idols or blood or animals that were strangled. And one of them is about sexual immorality. And then James says this about it in verse 21. For Moses has had throughout many generations those who preach him in every city, being read in the synagogues every Sabbath. Now, here's what I think that James is saying. I think James is saying the Gentiles do not have to come under Jewish law. They don't have to become Jews. But there are certain practices that Gentiles practice that are particularly offensive to Jewish people in their towns. He said in every town, every Gentile town has its synagogue. Every Gentile town has its Jews who have been conditioned for many generations from hearing the law read in the synagogue to have these sensitivities about certain things that Gentiles typically, especially pagan Gentiles who were not Christians, had been known to do. They were blatantly immoral, and they ate things the Jews found disgusting, like blood and strangled animals and meat sacrificed to idols. And I think what James is saying is, look, although we don't have to make these Gentiles become Jews, we should make them be sensitive to the conscience of the Jewish people in their towns so that they don't unnecessarily offend the Jews. They should be allowed to know that these behaviors are offensive to people who've been hearing Moses in their synagogues read for generations, and therefore ask the Gentiles to abstain from these behaviors. Now, this is not the same thing as saying that the Gentiles are morally obligated to avoid eating things strangled, for example, or meat sacrificed to idols. Certainly, they are morally required to abstain from fornication. And when Paul and Silas carried this letter that James wrote, and they carried it to the Gentile churches, it would appear when you read 1 Corinthians, which was written after Paul took the letter to the Corinthians and then left Corinth, and he wrote back to them, that the people, the Gentiles, had gotten some confusion over the matter because they were thinking, okay, well, it's okay to eat meat sacrificed to idols, but they apparently were tolerant of sexual immorality also. And
okay,
so Paul...
Okay. Can I interject here for a second, Steve?
Sure.
Mm-hmm. What I really want to understand here is that the four things that were given to the converted Gentiles coming into converting to believing in the Messiah.
Yeah.
Okay. This was a standard that was to be accepted. All four of these issues, the not eating of blood of animals, which would identify the strangled animals. Okay, and then the blood, which I believe happens to involve the menstruation of a woman. Okay, since we're talking about fornication, we're talking about cleanness, and this would support 1 Corinthians 6:17. Come out of her, my people, touch not the unclean thing, and I will receive you unto myself.
Okay.
So these things are very necessary for today, for the Christian community at large. They need to observe it. Secondly, Moses is preached in every synagogue on the Sabbath, okay, in every city. All right, the intent here, I believe, Steve, is that when they come in, when the Gentiles come in to these four issues, that they are observing 1 Corinthians 6:17, coming out of her, my people, touch not the unclean thing, and I will receive you to, so in fact, that Moses would be preached the rest of the Torah, or the law of Moses, to these Gentiles coming in so that they would learn. You've got to remember, at the end of Acts, they wanted to hear more of what Paul had to say, and they were in the synagogue on the Sabbath at that time. So these are issues that are very important for the Christian community at large to understand, and that these are very applicable as it was then and it is today.
Well, that's certainly one opinion I've heard before. I disagree from my studies of what Paul wrote on the same subject afterward. Because he did write about some of these issues. He wrote certainly about sexual immorality, and he wrote about meat sacrificed to idols. That's two of the four things that are mentioned in the list.
And the blood. We have to understand that the blood is already generated back in the book of Genesis through Noah, that they were not to eat the blood. It was to be poured out on the ground. But yet we have Christians eating blood everywhere.
Now, eating blood, you mean not fully draining the blood out of the meat like the Jews do?
Exactly, like pouring it out and making certain that the meat is well, what the Jews call is kosher. Okay,
yeah.
It's kosher for eating, and it's applicable. That was the whole reason. I mean, if you look at the first of Acts 15, it speaks of the Pharisees who believed in the Messiah. Okay,
right.
So they had knowledge of the law. There was absolute knowledge of the law.
Sure, but they were also the troublemakers that Paul had to deal with.
Well,
they were the ones that were saying the Gentiles had to be circumcised.
Okay, well, that may be, but that was too much for the Gentiles to endure at the time. It was not a requirement.
So you believe now? Wait, you believe now that Gentiles should be circumcised?
Well, that's not the issue right now.
Well, no, but I'm asking you: Do you believe now that Gentiles should be circumcised?
If they want to keep the Passover, they need to.
Okay, well, see, well, then you and Paul would have a serious problem with the book of Galatians, right?
No, not at all. Because
he said if you get circumcised, Christ avails you nothing. You've fallen from grace.
No, if you're circumcised, if you're a Greek, he will avail you nothing. If you're a Jew, he will avail you nothing. That's what this is exactly what is being spoken of in 1 Corinthians 7:19. It says, no matter if you're circumcised or if you're uncircumcised, and that's referring to Jew or it's referring to greed. It makes no difference, but keeping the commandments of the Almighty is what matters. Okay, so he made it specifically clear that the commandments were to be kept. Okay, it doesn't matter if you're Jew or Gentile.
Which commandments? Which commandments?
He's speaking in all the commandments.
So we should offer animals? Should we offer animal sacrifices then?
Absolutely not. Hebrews is already saying that.
But there's commandments. There's commandments to do that.
Pardon me?
There are commandments to offer animal sacrifices.
Okay, but we have to look at the prophecies, and we need to look at what Isaiah 53 is all about. Okay.
Well, I know that. I know that. But what I'm saying is that's exactly right. Isaiah 53 and Hebrews, which you've mentioned both of, they do indicate that some of those commandments are not binding anymore. There's a final sacrifice.
We're only talking about the sacrificial sacrifice here of the Messiah is what we're talking about. That is what's covered. All the sacrifices in the past and in the future is under his umbrella. Okay, the fact that he gave himself for his people.
And you don't think that being circumcised in heart covers for all the obligation to be circumcised?
But you know what? That has to come first, and that's what Acts 15 is all about. Because you couldn't get a Gentile to come off the street and just
okay.
say, you know,
well,
they don't
let
have
me
that
clarify something, because we're going to hear music in just a moment. In fact, I'm going to be cut off. We're going to hear music playing to close the show in just about
okay.
5 seconds.
I really appreciate you having me on. If you would like, give me a call. I'd like to talk with you.
Well, I probably won't have time for that, but I've talked to Judaizers before, and I don't agree with your view of the law. I think that the ceremonial law has been fulfilled, and that there's where the Spirit of the Lord is, there's liberty. I don't think that I don't think the moral laws, I don't think God's moral standards have changed at all.
But do you think that Christians need to keep the four agreements that James came up with? Do you think that is?
Well, I would like to have explained. I would like to have explained my position on that, but you actually didn't want me to. You wanted to go another direction. But I will be glad to talk about that tomorrow when I have time.
Okay, I'll make it a point to call tomorrow and talk with you and extend that out.
All right.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for your call, Michael.
Bye.
Okay, bye now. Well, you've been listening to the Narrow Path radio broadcast, and my name is Steve Gregg. We do this Monday through Friday from 2 to 3 in the afternoon. And if you'd like to be a part of the show any weekday, you can always call with your questions or your disagreements with the host, like Michael had there and some others. I actually appreciate people calling up to disagree. It's a stimulating thing for us to think about more than one point of view and see if the scriptures support something maybe different than what we've always believed. But we really have to be teachable if we're going to do that. If you're interested in keeping this show on the air where you're listening, I just want you to know the time for us to pay the radio stations is coming up again at the end of this month. And we pay them in real money that has to come in from, well, where does it have to come in from? We trust God to provide it, to tell you the truth. But we have found that in the past, most of it comes from listeners. We don't have any sponsors. We don't sell anything. And we don't do much to generate money. We just let you know that if you want to keep hearing the radio show, we have to pay the radio bills. And if you'd like to write to us, the address is The Narrow Path, P.O. Box 3633, Santa Cruz, California, 95063. That's The Narrow Path, P.O. Box 3633. Santa Cruz, California, 95063. We also have a website, of course. Everybody does these days. And that is thenarrowpath.com. You can, if you wish, make a donation there. There is a PayPal link, and you can donate from the website. You can also find our address there. But more importantly, you can find a lot of resources, hundreds of MP3 files, hundreds that are all free. There's nothing for sale at our website. Everything is just available for you to take. Check it out. It's thenarrowpath.com. Thanks for joining us. By the way, I have a Tuesday night study tonight in Santa Cruz for you listening. We'll talk to the rest of you tomorrow. God bless.